Good morning, good noon, good afternoon, depending on what part of the world you are in. So this is an opportunity for us to get together again in our discussion of Midrash. It's a pleasure to see everybody. If I don't see your faces, it's because you've got your video off, and that's your prerogative. If you can turn it on, it's always helpful to me to see faces and the people that I am engaging with and talking to. We are in the third of our classes, starting now. I just wanted to remind everybody of that which I mentioned last week, which is that originally this was scheduled to be a six-week series, and because of the way it planned out, and a little bit on my part, I had planned an extra week without realizing it, we're going to turn this into a seven-week series. So thank you to Torah in Motion. We're going to tag on one additional week, which will be the Wednesday immediately following Shavuot. So Shavuot will be in between class 6 and now our new additional class 7. So you can mark your calendars that there's a one additional session in this series. If I could trouble you, at least those who have your cameras, to give me a thumbs up if you can hear me, just to make sure that we're all good. Okay, excellent. I'm just going to unmute. Okay. Where we are at. So I need to share a page, a source page with you. If you have not, if you've, the source pages are always uploaded to the Torah in Motion website. If you didn't get it from there, it'll be posted on the chat momentarily if it's not already there. It's already there. And I'm going to share my screen with you so you have them on the page as well. This is our third session. And one second, I need to just do one thing. Okay. And today we're going to do a deep dive into what is referred to as Rashi's methodology in the quotation of Midrash. So we're slowly approaching the core of the subject, meaning we started with, you know, the title of the series is the methodology of Midrash, and that's an almost impossible topic to really address in totality because there is no single methodology to Midrash. It's really the insight and approach or philosophy of each rabbi and their understanding of the text throughout the period of Chazal. So if we look at the period of Chazal, starting with the earliest Mishnayot, all the way till the end of the Talmud and even the Gaonic period, you're looking at 1,000 years of Jewish literature and genre. So throughout that period of time, different rabbis had different approaches to Midrash that are dramatically different. So there's no single methodology, but as an overall approach to dealing with text, we started with a kind of a general background. We went backwards in time almost to say, okay, is Midrash part of a kind of a masoret, binding, legal structure that we are obligated to and connected to in our commitment of Na'aseh v'Nishma in terms of its interpretation of the text? And we saw pretty much across the board that was not the case, that Drash in terms of interpretation is really based on how each rabbi saw the text. Then we looked at the commentaries, the classic Rishonim, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, Radak a little bit, and looked at how they ask the question, are we interpreting text based on how we see the text, how we understand Pshat, or are we interpreting the text based on how our rabbis in the various works of the Midrash spanning 1,000 years saw the text, which would be more complicated, especially because there's no single monolithic view. But we saw across the board that the Rishonim took the approach of trying to address the Pshat, the simple, direct text in context, as I like to call it, understanding, and therefore kind of look at Midrash as an opinion to take into consideration when looking at that, but not necessarily the sole one. We are slowly heading towards an analysis of Midrashim themselves, but first we need to take a stop at this topic today, which is Rashi's approach to quoting Midrash. I think it's a foregone conclusion. It's pretty self-explanatory that most Midrashim that we're familiar with, from the works of Rashi. Actually, for one second, I'm just going to stop sharing. Most of us are familiar with Midrashim overall from the work of Rashi. Rashi's interpretation of Chumash is filled with very colorful Midrashim from every genre of Midrash across the board. And so to the extent that it's even hard to recognize Rashi in a consistent fashion as somebody loyal to his own declaration that his purpose is to explain the Pshat and not the Midrash. Rashi's so full of the commentary has so many Midrashim in it. This led to an enormous debate for many years as to what really is Rashi's methodology. Some suggest that even though Rashi says that he is a Pashtan, that he's Pshat-oriented, really he is Drash-oriented, that he really wants to explain the Midrash and to quote as many Midrashim as possible. There is some of even Rashi's own commentaries on Rashi make the observation that the goal of Rashi was to quote as many Midrashim as possible. There's an enormous amount of literature around an understanding of Rashi's interpretation. And what I want to share with you today is a glimpse into the methodology, the insights that I learned from Nechama Leibowitz, Zichrona Livracha. Nechama Leibowitz really was the trailblazer in terms of a study of Rashi in our generation, in general in Parshanut. It was an extraordinary story. If you haven't either had the experience of learning from her or reading her material, I would encourage you to do so. A lot of it's available in English, and more obviously available in Hebrew. But she has in the back of her book on Sefer Shmot an additional piece in which she wrote an article entitled Rashi's Methodology in the Quotation of Midrash. And I remember a lot of this discussion that I had the benefit of hearing from her in person revolved around the question, is there a methodology? Does Rashi simply quote Midrashim whenever he wants or whenever he can? Or is there a methodology to Rashi's mindset and discussion and discerning where and when he would quote Midrash and to what end? To what end? Just to kind of draw in the debate of Rashi, I remember Nechama telling us a number of occasions there are more commentaries written on Rashi, what we call super commentaries on Rashi, than there are books on Shakespeare. Rashi has generated a entire body of study of Rashi's own commentary. And the opinions vary from those, I think there's a... an opinion of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who held that Rashi was written with the intent of being a commentary for a five-year-old child. And therefore, many of the Midrashim are there to enhance the educational experience of a child. And the Chama had a different take on Rashi's methodology, but you understand that that is part of the challenge. What is there a methodology to Rashi? We're certainly not going to exhaust that topic today. We're just going to touch on it a little bit. Nechama was a trailblazer in a number of methodological approaches to the study of Rashi. One was, of course, the famous question, what's bothering Rashi? That whole approach to try to look at Rashi as a comment on a text and then ask the question, what question, problem, challenge in the text prompted Rashi to make the comment that he does? Nechama, I don't know if you know the story to how Nechama's commentary got written, but for the first 50 years before she wrote her books, she had a process by which it was called the Gilyonot, by which she would write up a series of questions, mainly on Rashi, but certainly on other commentaries too, And she had a mailing list. And she would mail out this list of questions without answers. And people all over the world would be on this mailing list, and they would receive her gilyonot, they were called. And then they would spend the week trying to struggle with answering these questions. They would write the answers, as long before computers, they would handwrite the answers to these questions and mail them back to her. And we're talking about thousands of people on her mailing list. It was for many years run through Mizrahi. And I think it started in the 1950s, I believe. And she then, or in the 1940s, and then she would answer, she would correct each one by hand and mail them back. And in 1989 and 1990, I had the schus of studying with her, and one of our visits to her house, on her desk, she had this little kind of folder, and in it you could see handwritten letters. And somebody asked her, what are those? And she said, well, those are letters that people write to me with answers to the questions in the Gilyonot, and I respond and correct them and write them back, which means that she was doing this for close to 50 years. And that's how she trained a generation of teachers and students. And so much of her world revolved around this question. What is the methodology? What is bothering Rashi in the text to try to understand what is prompting Rashi's comment, especially if it involves the quotation of a midrash? She was famous for the statement, every statement is an answer to a question. To know what the what's the question, that is the question. And that's how she approached Rashi. The other thing she drilled into us time and time again, and it's important to understand her mindset in order to, at least a part of it, in order to approach this topic, was that there's a distinction to be made between a question and a problem. A question typically is why. So why does the text say this? Why does the text say that? That is not, in Nechama's worldview, that was never a valid question or observation, because the answer to every why question is always going to be, why not? Why not? To her, it was never about a question. It was always about a difficulty, a kushi, a challenge in the text, a contradiction, a linguistic issue, the use of the wrong pronoun or a dangling modifier or an ambiguity or a contradiction or a philosophical question challenge in the text, whatever it was. But there was always something to which you can never start a comment on what's bothering Rashi. The question of why does it say this was always had to be followed with, because otherwise it should have said X, Y, or Z. There's always a follow-up. And I want to start, and what I've done is I've collected a number of examples that address the question of what's bothering Rashi, but in so doing, we're also going to look at, and that's the subject for today, we're also going to look at when Rashi engaged these kinds of questions or problems in the text. When did he resort to quoting Medrash as a solution to those textual issues? And what are the methodologies by which Rashi selected the Midrashim in his application to the text? So that's our goal for today, and then, Bezrat Hashem, next week, we will begin to explore, specifically from the Medrash side, methodology of some Midrashim themselves and how they fit independent of the commentaries. So I'm going to share now, I'm going to share the screen, and we're going to jump into, you should have this in the source page as well. This is the source page I prepared for you, Darkosha Rashi Bavat Midrashim, which is the title of Nechama's article. This is entirely based on Nechama's article. There are other articles and other discussions on the same topic. If you Google it, you'll see many articles written about the same topic. I chose, because I had the schus of learning from her, to kind of channel this particular shir from her directly. So here's a classic example of what I mean by a difficulty in the text. Rashi will quote a medrash, when there's a challenge in the text that needs an answer. So here's a very famous one. Example number one. In Shemot Perek Yudalad, it says that the Egyptians chased after Israel. They're at the banks of the Red Sea. They overtook them and camped at the sea, all of the horses and chariots of Pharaoh. And Paro hikriv, Paro approached, Israel lifted up their eyes, and Israel, and they saw Egypt advancing after them. They were frightened, and they cried out to God. Rashi's comment is on the words Mitzrayim Noseh Achrehem. Rashi will always tell you the phrase to which he's making the observation, Egypt chasing after them, Noseh Achrehem. To which Rashi says, and he quotes the Medrash, Belev Echad Ki Ish Echad, like one person, sorry, with one heart, like one person. Unity. That's Rashi's comment. Rashi makes a similar comment, almost identical, not quite, in the context of a pasuk four chapters later, in Shemot Perek Yutet, Vayisum Refidim, Vayavo Midbar Sinai, Israel encamped from Refidim, they arrived at the desert of Sinai, Vayachanu Bamidbar, they encamped at the desert, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, and Israel encamped there opposite the mountain. Says Rashi, Vayichan Sham Yisrael, they encamped there, Ki Ish Echad Belev Echad, like one man with one heart. Aval Shar Kol HaChanuyot V'tar Umat U'machloket, but all the other encampments were filled with complaints and divisiveness. This one was, in anticipation of Ma'amar HaSinai, was unified. So Rashi makes virtually the exact same comment in two different places. One with regards to Mitzrayim at Yamsuf, and the other with regards to Israel at HaSinai. And of course, the immediate question is, and both of these are quotations from the Medrash, what is bothering Rashi? In other words, what is in the text that's driving Rashi or prompting Rashi to make this observation that Egypt was coming after them with one heart like one person, or Israel was encamped at the mountain like one person with one heart? This is a fairly easy textual observation to recognize. And I want to, before we dive into it, repeat something which I said a couple of weeks ago, which is that one of the challenges with all commentary is we tend to work off translation, and it does a terrible disservice. It's necessary, because not all of us are fluent in Hebrew. But so much of the world of exegesis and textual analysis that's in the commentaries is based on the nuance of Hebrew grammar. And the moment we translate into a language that doesn't carry the same grammatical structure, we lose the nuance. And that's exactly what happens here. If you look at the English translation, you won't see what it is that Rashi saw. So what is it that Rashi saw in the case of, let's do one at a time, Shemot Yudalad, where it says that they saw Egypt running after them like one with one heart, like one man, unified? What is it that Rashi saw in the text that bothered him to the point where he felt a need to make this comment?
And the first verb is in the plural, v'yirdafu Mitzrayim, and then what Rashi's commenting on, Noseya Achareihem, Noseya is in the singular form.
Right. The verbs in this text tend to be in the plural, Mitzrayim, chased after them, vayudafu, vayasigu otam, they caught up to them at the sea, they parohi vayisu ibnei Yisrael et enehem, Israel lifted up their eyes, again in the plural, Israel in the plural, vayisu, until you see v'inei Mitzrayim nosea achrehem, Egypt running after them. And here nosea is in the singular lashon yechid. So if you understand the nuance of Hebrew language, again, the question isn't just, you could use a collective noun and conjugate it in the singular. It's perfectly legitimate to say, Mitzrayim Noseya, Egypt is traveling in a singular. What's odd is the constant use of the plural throughout the same text, and then jumping to the singular. That shift, that's what's concerning Rashi. In other words, it's not just that it says Mitzrayim in the singular Nosea, it's that all the other verbs are in the plural. And so, to answer that question, Rashi turned to the Medrash. Okay? I'll come back to the Medrash itself in a second. Let's look at the second example. Vayichan Sham Yisrael, Israel encamped there, Ish Echad B'Lev Echad. Here too, Vayichan is in the singular. In English, we would say it encamped instead of they encamped. Vayichan Sham Yisrael, it referring to Israel. That's a singular noun, a collective noun, legitimate. Except that if you look at the rest of the text, it's Vayisu Mirfidim, they traveled from Mirfidim. Vayavo, they came to Midbar Sinai. Vayachanu, they encamped. Vayichan Sham Yisrael. And so Rashi shifted to the Midrash, Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad, to address the question, why is the emphasis here in the singular? And the answer being, it reflects the sense of unity that they achieved in their arrival at Sinai, but not in the other encampments. And here Rashi makes that observation, right? Vayisum Rifidim, when they traveled from Rifidim, they weren't so unified. When they came to Midbar Sinai, they weren't so unified. Vayachanu Bamidbar, they encamped in the desert, is also in the plural. They weren't so unified. Only here, in the singular, and therefore Rashi adds from the Medrash, that all of the other encampments were divided, only this one was united, because that's what he's seeing in the text. In the emphasis in the text. So there's an example where Rashi would borrow the Medrash, or use the Medrash, and apply it specifically because of the textual issue that he is seeing. Now, is that the methodology of the Midrash itself? Is that the intent of the rabbi who composed this particular Medrash? You'd have to go back to the source of the Midrash and see if that was the intention of the Midrashic author, but that is certainly the intention of Rashi in his application or quote of this text. Complete aside, and not really part of my class this morning, but I thought it was so interesting I would share it with you. Rashi does something else in this Medrash. And if you look at it carefully, he makes a very subtle switch in the language. When it refers to an example number one, referring to Egypt, he says, "Belev echad ki ish echad," with one heart like one man. And with referring to Israel, he flips it and he says, "Like one man with one heart, ki ish echad belev echad." The order is reversed. Is that intentional? Is that simply to say they're equal, right? Reflecting unity. I would argue that it's about whether intent unifies the group or the group unifies to a common goal. If the intent, if the goal is what unifies the group, then it could be that it is of temporary nature. Take a group of disparate people, give them a singular goal, and you unify them through the goal. Lev Echad, the goal, unifies them into one man. In the case of Egypt, the unity is how Israel perceived Egypt. He named Mitzrayim Nasiachem is how Israel perceived the Egyptians. They looked up and saw the Egyptians and felt that sense of unity amongst them. That's the goal, the Lev Echad, unifying them as well. Whereas in the case of Bnei Israel at Har Sinai, it's the people that are unified, ki ish echad, because they are one people, because they are inherently unified. They are Am Yisrael. And therefore, vayis'u, they achieved that unity even before they came to Matan Torah. They encamped their unified vayichan sham Yisrael. So the text also reflects a little bit of that nuance in terms of who's perceiving this unity. Okay, that's one example. The second example that I gave you here is more subtle and much more challenging. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but I just want to move on to other examples, but I'll just share with you what it is. Briefly, when it says that the king of Egypt died, and Bnei Israel sighed from the slavery, they cried out to God, and the cry went up to God, and you heard their cry. So Rashi makes the observation, which is right out of the Medrash Rabbah, Vayamat Melech Mitzrayim Nitztara. He didn't die, but he became smitten with Tzara'at, and his doctors told him that in order to heal him from Tzara'at, he had to slaughter babies and bathe in their blood. You'll forgive the graphic picture. Right. That's Rashi's comment. Now, that's a very classic Midrashic comment. There's no indication in the text of this kind of barbarism and anger and slaughtering Jewish children to bathe in their blood. I mean, that story doesn't exist in the text. The question is, why does Rashi quote it? So why the Midrash quotes it is a different issue. But why does Rashi quote such a odd myth? The text says that he died. Vayamat Melech Mitzrayim. So why does Rashi say he didn't die? He only became a mitzora, and a mitzora is considered as somebody who, in a certain sense, has died. Mitzora chashiv kimet. So here, Nechama quotes the observation of the Vilna Gaon, who says that if you look throughout Tanakh, all kings are referred to by their title Melech, except when they die. When they die, the title is removed from them. So by Shmuel, or by Shaul, it says that instead of calling him a Melech Shaul, it says Vayamot Shaul. Shaul died. Or by David, it says Vayishkav David imavotav. David died. It doesn't say Melech David. Because, says the Gra, Ein Shulton b'yam ha-mavet, the notion is that on the day of death, you're not the king anymore. The king, the reign of the throne has gone on to the next king. And so what caught Rashi's eye was the reference to Vayamot Melech Mitzrayim instead of just saying Vayamot Paro, or some other description, but the death of the king is odd because typically the king, the term Melech, wouldn't be applied in this case. And there might be other exceptions, but that essentially, the Gra says, is what's driving Rashi's quote of the Medrash. So what I've tried to show you in this introduction is that essentially when Rashi quotes a Medrash, it's not an arbitrary attempt to kind of fill the text with color and stories that we can then use as stories to tell our children. What Rashi is trying to do is address very specific textual issues, which he feels at that moment is addressed by the particular Midrash, maybe in a way that's even better than other less Midrashic attempts to address the text. We'll see that in a few minutes. So that's the question that we're sort of the overarching question of this shir is, did Rashi have a methodology in terms of how, when, and where he would quote Midrash? And the answer to that question, of course, is not only that I assume he did, but he actually had many methodologies. And what I want to share with you is, time permitting, four examples of how Rashi, how we can see that Rashi had a methodology and a thought process to his choice of Midrash. Not just that he did, but how we can see that he did. For example, there are places where Rashi will give you a pshat and a pasuk, and then he'll tell you that there's a Midrash that exists, but he's not quoting it, because he doesn't think the Midrash is pshat. So he'll quote the existence of a Medrash without telling you what the Medrash is. He'll reject the Medrash. He'll say, for example, Yesh bezem midrashei agada, there is in this text some agadic interpretation. Ach ze yishivo shel mikra, but I don't think it's pshat. I'm giving you what I think is pshat. That's fascinating in itself, what I refer to here as referencing but not quoting. And there are other places where Rashi had a selection of potential midrashic answers to a question challenged by a particular textual issue. Many answers that appear in the midrash, Rashi chose one. So if Rashi's goal was to just throw at us all the midrashic stories that Midrash says, then he would quote them all. But he doesn't. He quotes one out of a host of possible examples, and that means that he's very selective because he believes that this midrashic approach answers the question, what I call selective quoting. Another methodology of Rashi is where he will selectively repeat a midrash, meaning you have a particular style of Medrash that appears in many places in Tanakh. Rashi will quote it in some places, but not others. Because he's saying, okay, here I see the answer that this Midrashic source gives me to the textual challenge, and in other places, he doesn't. Or, one of the most dramatic examples, is where the Medrash will quote a particular insight in one place in Chumash, or Tanakh, and Rashi will quote the same Medrash, but he'll shift it, he'll move it, to a completely different place in Tanakh, where the Medrash doesn't exist. I'm going to try, time permitting, to show you examples of all four of these methodologies of Rashi's working with the Medrash in different ways. So let's go back up to the first of these methodologies. Rashi's referencing of Midrash, but not quoting it. This is a very powerful example. So the Pasuk in Bereshit by Kain and Hevel, Bereshit Perek Dalet, says the following. And here again, I put the translation on the page because I think it's important for those who need it. But understand that a translation is a commentary. The translation has already biased the question. So in the Hebrew it says, Vayomer Kain el Hevel Achiv. The best translation I can give to that is, Kain said to Hevel his brother, Vayi biyotam basadeh, as it came to be when they were in the field, Vayakum Kain al Hevel achiv vayargehu, Kain was up against Hevel his brother and killed him. To which Rashi says the following, Vayomer Kain al Hevel, Kain said to Hevel, Nichnas imo b'divrei riv umetza. He entered into him with words of quarrel and contention. He struggled with him. He started up with him. He began to fight with him. Litgolel alav lohargo. In order to find a pretext by which to kill Cain, by which to kill Hevel. V'yesh b'zeh midrashei agada, ach zeh yishuvo shel mikra. There are many agadic interpretations, but this is the simple, plain meaning of the text. The phrase, Vayomer Kain el Hevel, means that he started up with him, he entered with him into words of quarrel and contention, Nichnasimo b'divariv u'metza. All right, before we even get to the question, to the Medrash, I think it's not a difficulty to find. What is bothering Rashi? What's the difficulty in the text that prompted Rashi's comment? And here, if the translation is already going to, unfortunately, bias and clear and our ability to see this challenge. What's the difficulty Rashi is struggling with? Feel free to unmute and join in.
There seems to be a hole in the text. It says, it seems maybe there should have been a quote. Kain right. said to his brother, but what did he say?
Correct. Vayomer Kain el Hevel achiv. Kain said to Hevel his brother. Into this space here, in every other instance, and here's the power of it. In every other instance of Vayomer Ploni el Ploni, someone said to someone else, the term Vayomer is followed by what they said. Vayomer, Ploni, someone said to someone else, X, Y, and Z. It's the beginning of a quote. Vayibu Yotamba Sadeh is already the next phrase. It came to be when they were in the field, etc. So you can see that what the translation has done, the translation has said, okay, we're going to translate this as Cain spoke to Hevel, his brother, rather than the English Cain said to Hevel, his brother. Because the English has already addressed the difficulty with a different interpretation. Rashi's interpretation is he said to him something that caused them to fight. He entered into a quarrel with him. He got into a fight with him. Fine. I can live with that interpretation. Why does Rashi tell me there's a Medrash? So let's look at the Midrash. The Midrash asks exactly this question. What were they fighting about? So, the Medrash will give three different answers. Amru, they said, let's divide the world. One took the land, the other took the chattels. This one said, your ground you're standing on is mine. The other one said, what you're wearing is mine. This one said, take it off. This one said, go fly. And eventually, Cain rose up against his brother and killed him. Vayakum Cain al Hevelachiv vayargeu. Rabbi Yeshua of Sichnin, in the name of Rabbi Levi, said, Shneim natlu et hakakot, v'shneim natlu et hametaltelin. No, they both divided the land. They both divided the chattels. That's not the issue. Amayu medainim, what were they fighting about? Zelmer b'tchumi beit mikdash nivneh, v'zelmer b'tchumi beit mikdash nivneh. This one was saying, the temple will be built in my territory, and this one was saying, the temple will be built in my territory. This one says, they're in the field refers to the Beit HaMikdash, as the Pasuk in Micha says, Tzion Sadeh Techeresh, and therefore Cain came and killed Hevel. Yehuda by Ami Omer, third opinion, Al Chava HaRishonah Yumadanim, they were arguing about who would marry Eve, who would get the first woman. Says Rashi, there is Midrashei Akedah, but they don't answer the question properly, they don't give me text in context or pshat. Okay, so let's ask the question. Why does Rashi reject these three Midrashim? First of all, let's understand what the Medrash is. What is this, essentially, what is this Medrash, what is the Medrash's answer to the question, what were they arguing about? And what is the argument between them? Why is there three opinions? So simply put, if you looked at the three options, property, religion, and sex, karka, Beit HaMikdash, Chava, what essentially you have in the Medrash is a reflection on what are the three classic sources of all conflict in the world. It doesn't matter what the conflict is, whether it be a conflict between people, conflict between families, conflict between countries, conflict between global powers and superpowers. At the end of the day, this conflict is going to be defined by one of three variables, either land / money, or religion, or theology, or sex or some related issue. Gen. That's it. Those are the three domains of all conflict in the world. It's a very powerful insight. By in and of itself, it's a medrash that has extraordinary insight into human nature. Says Rashi, it exists. There is such a medrash. But it's not pshat. Why is it not pshat? Why does Rashi reject it?
Because it's got nothing to do with Cain and Hevel.
That in itself wouldn't stop Rashi from quoting the Medrash. There are other places.
Why would they be arguing over marrying their mother?
Maybe the last one, but the first two are certainly relevant. The first one for sure is relevant.
It tries to say exactly what they're arguing about when there's no way to know from the text what it was about.
But that necessarily wouldn't stop Rashi. There are other places where Rashi will insert a Midrashic story that has no basis in the text whatsoever because it answers a pshat. So much more textual answer to this question. Why does Rashi reject these three options? I think the answer is very straightforward. Who's to blame in the arguments of the Medrash? Who is responsible for the argument? In the language of the Medrash, who's arguing here?
Both of them.
Both of them. In the language of the Medrash, they're arguing with each other. Cain says one thing, Hevel responds, this one says this, this one says this. They're both arguing. There's no way to assess who's right and who's wrong, who's on the right side, who's on the just side, and who's on the unjust side. Whereas in the text, that's not the case. The text presents a clear guilty party in this conflict. Vayomer Cain el Hevel Achiv. Cain started up with Hevel, his brother. Cain killed Hevel, his brother. The blame is not equal. There's not a, it's not two sides to the story. There's one side to the story. And any midrashic answer that attempts, am I frozen? No, good. Any midrashic answer that attempts to place blame on both sides, Rashi will reject. So that's an example where Rashi, at the end of the day, has an answer to the question that's still unsatisfactory because we're still missing the quote. Rashi has to retranslate from Cain said to Hevel to Cain spoke with Hevel, as the translation here is, which is in accordance with Rashi. Right, he has to retranslate the words, but, and so he's sort of a little uncomfortable there. We're left with a gaping hole. What are they arguing about? The Medrash will attempt to answer that question, but Rashi says, Ein ze yishuvo shel mikra, unsatisfactorily. Why? Because the Medrash places blame on both sides, and Rashi says, only one. Here's another example. Here's a different example. We're going to shift now to category number two, which is I call selective quoting, where Rashi, where the Medrash, there are multiple answers in the Medrash to a question, and Rashi rejects some of them and accepts others based on the textual issue. In Shemot Perek Zayin, we have the following pasuk: Kol Amar Hashem, Bizot Tedak Yeni Hashem, this you will know that I am God. Behold, I will smite with my staff the water in the Nile, and it will turn to blood. Says Rashi, "Lefi she'en gshamim yordim b'mitzrayim." There's no rain in Mitzrayim. "V'nilus oleu mashkeat ha'aretz." The Nile was the source of water for the entire country. "U'mitzrayim ovdim l'nilus," and the Nile was a deity in the culture of Egypt. Therefore, lefichach hilkat yiratam, God smote their deity first, v'achakach hilkaotam, and then he smote them. But he started with smiting the Nile because it was a way of starting with the deities of Egypt. That's Rashi, and it's a direct or a paraphrase from a midrash. The midrash, there are actually several. In Shmot Rabbah, we find what the question, Lama lakua mayim tchila badam, why were the waters of the Nile smitten first? Says the Medrash, Mifnei sheparo v'amitzim ovdim la'yor, because Paro and the Egyptians, they worship the Nile. And God said, I will first deal with their deity and then with the people. That more or less is what Rashi quotes. But there are two other Midrashim. Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer that says, why did God bring upon them the blood, the plague of blood? Because the Egyptians had thrown the Israelite babies into the sea. And therefore the waters of the Egyptian, of the Nile were smitten for having played a role in that terrible crime. Medrash Tehillim or Medrash Lekachtov. Medrash Lekachtov is different from the Medrash Tehillim. Medrash Shachatov is Medrash Tehillim. Lefi sheshafchu damam sheyisrael kamayim, because the Egyptians spilled the Israelite blood like water, therefore their waters were turned to blood. Three midrashim. Rashi only quotes one. Why? Why does he reject the other two? And here he doesn't even tell you the other two exist. You wouldn't even know that the other two exist were it not for somebody to have collected them and put them on a page and said, okay, here are two other answers to this question. Assuming Rashi knew them, which we have to assume, why did he reject them?
Yeah.
Okay. And the answer, I think, is also pretty simple in the text. Namely, what is the purpose of the plague of turning the water to blood according to each medrash? What purpose does the plague serve? in the first instance, smiting the Egyptian deity, what purpose does the plague serve? It serves the purpose of?
Showing the power of
Hashem. It serves an educational purpose. It demonstrates God's power to the Egyptians. In the source 16 and 17, in the next two midrashim, what purpose does the plague of the blood, the water, turning the waters of the Nile to blood serve?
Revenge.
Right. Punishment.
Exactly. Revenge.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Revenge or punishment. Now go back to the text. And Rashi is very textual. How do I know in the text that the plague is educational and not vengeful? Exactly. The text tells me the purpose of the plague. And so Rashi looked at the options, right? Why is the plague the firstborn? Now, there's a bigger question. Why not start with the Nile? Why not start with blood? I think the bigger question is the fact that the plague of the firstborn was supposed to be the only plague, right? That's the one that Moshe was given at the Sneh. And so the question starts around why there's other plagues before I get to the plague of the firstborn. That's a sort of a more broader question. But in this particular text, Bezot Teidai, this you will know, this is an educational message. The only medrash of the three that answers the educational message is V'nevchu L'dam, is this one. All right. There are other examples in the book. I'll leave that for you for another time. Selective midrashim, or selective repetition, where there's a medrash that appears in a number of places, and Rashi chooses to quote it in some places and not others. I give you two examples here. Time permitting, I'll come back to this one. It's a beautiful example, the story of Migdal Bavel and Lot. I won't have time to do other examples if I do this one, because it's a long one. So I'm going to skip it. Time permitting, we'll come back to it. I want to do this one. This is a really powerful one. The notion of anonymity. There are many places in Tanakh where we find ambiguous personalities, stories of people who are identified without a name. And very often, Rashi will insert a name to that person. Will tell us who it is, even if it's not in the text. And this is directly out of the Medrash. The Medrash does this all the time. Examples. Vayavoa palit v'yaged l'Avraham ha'ivri. The fugitive came and he told Avraham about the capture of Lot. Who is this fugitive? Vayavoa palit. Who is this fugitive? Says Rashi. Lefi pshuto. Ze Og. Shepalat min ha'mechama. This is a reference to Og, who escaped the battle and who is referred to as Og. Yeter harifaim. There's a part of that medrash I got chopped off. Yeter harifaim. He is left over from the great giants, and therefore he's called the survivor from the great giants who were there before the flood. So says Rashi. Or another example. Rashi runs to feed the three malachim. He gives the meat, the calf, to the youth, in order to have him prepare it for the malachim. Who is the youth? Who is the na'ar? Says Rashi, Ze Yishmael. Is there any indication, l'chanchob ha-mitzvot, to train him in mitzvot? Is there any indication of the text that this is Yishmael? No, it's directly out of the Medrash. This is Rashi quoting the Medrash, identify the person, he tells you it's Yishmael. Another example, not only a person, a place. V'yifka b'makom, when Yaakov is running from Beersheba, and he goes to Lavan's house. He arrived at the place. He went to sleep there because it's sunset. And he took of the stones of the place and he placed them before his under his head. Rashi says, lo yizkira katu be'eza makom. The text doesn't tell us which place. It must be some place already mentioned elsewhere that we already know about. That must be Har Moriah, as it says, v'yarata makom rechok, gemara nechulin. And finally, a fourth place we see this tendency in Breishit. V'hem le'yaduki shomei Yosef ki amalitz binotam. They didn't know that Yosef understood them because the interpreter was between them. Who is the interpreter? Text doesn't say. Rashi adds, Zeh Menashe. This is a reference to his son Menashe. based on the Medrash and Bereishis Rabbah. So this is a classic example of Midrash, where the Midrash will add information that's not in the text. Right? It was referred to often as milui parim, right? Filling in the gaps. There's no indication in the text that the survivor who told Abraham about Sodom, about Lot, is Og, or that the Na'ar is Yishmael, or that this is the place where Yaakov was Har Moriah, or that the Melitz was Menashe. It doesn't say in the text anywhere. I have an ambiguous personality in the story that plays some role. Rashi interprets it. Rashi tells us who it is. Now, if I was doing this from the Midrash perspective, I would tell you that the Midrash has a you know the expression, nature abhors a vacuum? Well, Midrash abhors anonymity. And the Midrash will always, I will repeat this, the Midrash will always identify anonymous personalities if they have a role in the story. So, for example, you know the story of in Parshat Chayesara. Who does Avraham send to find a wife for Yitzchak? What's his name?
Eliezer. No, it's not in the text.
Oh. It's not in the text there. It is in the text somewhere else. It is in the text in Parshat Lech Lecha, Ben Mesek Beiti Yehuda Mesek Eliezer. But it's not in the text in Parsha Chayesara. In the text in Parsha Chayesara, he's referred to as Avdo Zkan Beito, his servant. And if you look in Parsha Chayesara, you'll see throughout the Parsha, his name is never mentioned. And the Medrash right away jumps on the beginning of the parak, Pasuk Bet, right away jumps on the fact that this is Eliezer. Rashi doesn't say it. Rashi does not say it. He quotes it later on. He mentions Eliezer by name, but only in a different context altogether. Or, in the case of the Makot Mitzrayim, Shemot Perek Tet, where it says, Hayared Dvar Hashem Ben Nisit Mikneu, anybody who fears God will take their cattle and bring it in from the plague of... If you trust the plagues, if you believe in the plagues, then don't leave your cattle out there for the plague of hail, because they'll be killed. The Gemara says that the one who is referring to here, the one who fears God, is Eov. Rashi does not quote that. Or the Pasuk by Pinchas, the whole story of Pinchas, in the end of Parshat Chukat. The Medrash says, Pinchas hu Eliyahu. Pinchas is Eliyahu, Eliyahu HaNavi. Rashi does not quote that. So I have many instances where I have anonymous figures or figures who play a role in more than one place in Tanakh, where the Medrash will identify the anonymous personality. Rashi does not. Rashi omits them. Rashi does not quote them. But then I have all of these other places where Rashi, out of nowhere, says, no, this Palit or this Na'ar, I'm going to tell you who it is, based on the Medrash. Why? So the answer here is very simple. Rashi had a simple rule. What did Source 24, you can't see it all at once, let me do this. What does Source 24, 26, 28, and 30 have in common that the others do not?
They attribute names to unknown people.
They're all unknown people. Why do the Medrash will always identify unknown personalities? Rashi will sometimes identify unknown personalities, but not
these all. These are all unknown altogether. Hamelitz, it's not a person. The other ones are more identified, and the Midrash is changing who they are. It's different. Right? Pinchas is not Eliyahu. Pinchas is Pinchas.
In the case of Shemot, Hayared Dvar Hashem is also very generic, and the Midrash says it's Eliyahu.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
The mention is redundant. You don't need to mention that. You could have just written, for example, Vayugadla Avram Ha'ivri.
Maybe. But I think it's about as generic as you can get, Vayivkaba Makom. I think there's something much more dramatic here in all four of these cases.
The thing that Rashi identifies tells you about Something no. about more about the person rather than the about them.
What's in the text that said to Rashi, I need to identify who this palit is. I need
hey,
to identify.
Hey, Hayadiyah.
Correct.
The hey.
Correct. The definitive article. The Hayadiyah. It doesn't say Vayavo palit. A refugee came from the battle. It says Hapalit, the refugee. Hanaar, the lad. Hamakom, the place. Hamilitz. Doesn't say ki militz benotam because a translator was between them. It says ki hamilitz benotam. The translator was with them. If there's a definitive article and we don't know who it is, says Rashi, no, that's no good. I need to, if the definitive article has to tell me that I need to know who this person is. And therefore, if it's not self-evident from the text, then Rashi will turn to the Medrash to resolve that question. But if it's without a heyadia of those kambetoya reed dvar Hashem, which is has a definitive article, but it's more generic for other reasons, or Pinchas is bechlal is not. I don't need to identify who he is because it says he's Pinchas, right? So if the text isn't telling me there's an ambiguity, there's a piece missing, there's a heyadia, then Rashi will not bother. Whereas the Medrash will always identify anonymous personalities. Here's another example which I really like. Rashi on Shmot Perek Dalet. So the Pasuk says in Shmot Perek Dalet, Vayikach Moshe Ishto Vet Vanav Vayarkivem Al HaChamor. Moshe took his wife and his sons, mounted them on the donkey, and headed back towards Mitzrayim. Says Rashi, Chamor hamiyuchad, the donkey that was designated, the special donkey. Hu hachamor shechabash Avraham l'akedat Yitzchak, that's the donkey that Avraham prepared for Akedat Yitzchak, that he rode onto Akedat Yitzchak, and that's the donkey that Melech HaMashiach will eventually be, will ride upon. He's referring to two other references to donkeys. Breshit Perek of Bet, where it says, Avraham got up in the morning, vayachaboshet chamaro, and he saddled his donkey. And the pasuk in Zechariah, about Melech, Hinei Malkech, Yavolach, Tzadik, V'nashau, Ani V'rochev Al Chamor. Now, Rashi does not quote this Medrash in the other two instances, even though the Medrash appears in all three places. He only quotes it in Shemot Perek Dalet. Why? Because only there is the Chamor written with the Heir Yediyah. So, the donkey, the donkey reference in other places, and so he'll quote the Midrash. All right. The last example that I prepared for you is what I call Medrash relocation, or reallocation, which is where Rashi will take a Medrash and move it. So the Medrash says in Breshit Perek of Dalet by Eliezer or Eved Avram, in the story in the conversation with the house of Lavan, Vayikoda Ish, when he hears, at the very beginning, when he hears Rivka identify who she is in her household, it says, Vayikoda Ish Vayishtachu LaHashem. He bowed down and he said, Baruch Hashem Elokei Adoni Avraham, blessed is God who has fulfilled his servant's mission. And Rashi, sorry, the Medrash there says, he bowed down, Mikan Shemodim Abserat Tavah, from here we learn to give thanks if we are told good news. Now Rashi quotes this, Mikan Shemodim Abserat Tova, but he quotes it on Pasuk Nun Bet. Vayikasher Shema Eved Avram et Divrehem Vayishtachu Arzel Hashem. When he heard them say that Rivka would go with you, he bowed down and he said, thanks. Right? And Rashi quotes this Medrash, but he moves it from Pasuk Chaf Vav to Pasuk Nun Bet. Why does he move it? That's the mystery. It's the same Medrash. Why not quote, it's the same phrase, Vayishtachu ha'atarza, Vayikoda ish Vayishtachu. But Rashi thought, here that Medrash is pshat, and here it's not. So the Mefarshim and Rashi struggle with this. Some suggest it's because this bowing is followed by a bracha, and so it's not a surprise to bow, he's offering a bracha. So when you offer a bracha, you have to bow. Whereas this bowing is not followed by a bracha, it must be for some other motivation. Hence, it's teaching us the lesson to give thanks for good news. The other suggestion is that he hasn't yet heard the completion of the mission. He doesn't know if Rivka is going to go, and so the Besorah Tova is not complete until the end. So that's just a smaller example of where Rashi will take a medrash and move it, because here it's textually sound or sounder in Rashi's opinion, and there it's not. All right, we're going to stop here. The one example that I didn't get to that's on your notes is this example in on page 31 from Migdal Bavel and Lot. You have the translation. This one's fairly straightforward. You're welcome to go through it on your own, and you'll see where why Rashi... Say that again?
Hi. Can I ask a question? Thank you. It was excellent. There's a Rashi, Vatishlach, Paro's daughter, Vatishlach et Amasa, that she sent her handmaidens, and Rashi says that her arm grew very long.
Right. Why does he quote that medrash there?
Because if it's something that could be a pshat that, you know, she sent, I have gotten into more trouble with Rebbeim when you say her arm stretched out, and I believe, you know, in the medrash, but they say, there's a little medrash like that. Why would this be brought if there is a very clear...
right.
It could have said Vatishlach Yada. Its choice of words is a little bit unusual.
Right.
So, yad is
what I'm going to suggest is the following. We could do this literally not only all day, but all night, all week, all year. And I value the question. You can, and we'll try, what I'll try to do is, if you don't mind, I'm happy for you to send me emails and or put in the chat. And if you want to come online next week, it'd be about 10 to 15 minutes earlier than Lashir, and maybe I'll try to address some of the questions that I'm not going to have time to address today in a time frame. What I will tell you is, however, I would be misleading you if I told you I knew the answer to every comment of Rashi. That was Nechama's specialty. And so the first place I would look is either in the commentaries on Rashi on the page, Sifrei Chachamim and Mizrahi, or in Nechama's books to see if she addresses that question. But that's the kind of question she would address. Why do you, A, identify a pshat, and then pull a medrash that doesn't seem to be necessary? In Rashi's worldview, it'll always be necessary, because there's always some deficiency. As Julian said, maybe it's because there's a simpler word to use, or that word had been used elsewhere, or a phrase appears elsewhere. Right? Those are the kinds of questions that would drive that the answer to that kind of question. So what I wanted to share with you today, and kind of a hope I did so quickly, but I'm hoping you get a taste of it, the article itself has many, many, many more examples, is the basic principle of, Chaim, my pleasure, the basic principle that the use of medrash in the application of an interpretation of a text is not for the purpose of telling me the midrashic story. Right, the story of the medrash is not the goal. The interpretation of the textual issue is the goal. And many mefarshim argue about whether or not Rashi came close to the mark or missed the mark. Right, that's why you have ultimately you have different opinions in the midrash. Where the what's the mark or what's the pshat? But the goal in Rashi was always, if there's a medrash to quote, it's because there's a textual question that needed to be addressed. Unfortunately, in today's world, we tend to do the opposite. We tend to take midrashim and give them a life on their own, which in the role of midrash study or homiletics has value. In the role of pshat Tanakh study, I wonder whether or not we do a disservice by confusing the text and its interpretation with the midrash. So for now, we've sort of left and have completed one part of this unit, which is our study of the commentary's approach to quoting medrash or rejecting medrash. And Bezrat Hashem, next week we're going to move into a whole different genre, which is biblical roots of midrashic stories. Often the notion, and this I learned from Rav Meidan, often the notion of certain stories in Tanakh or certain stories in the Medrash that we're so familiar with, but we think of them as a kind of obscure midrashim, but that's because we don't have the kind of breadth of knowledge of Tanakh that Chazal had and that Chazal assumed we had. And once you start to pull the pieces together, suddenly you find that there are biblical roots to some of these midrashic stories, then it gets life gets really fun. So that's our exploration over the next 2 weeks. All right? I will stop here.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. So again, if you have questions specific, then I'll get on 15 minutes beforehand, then you're welcome to join me. We can kind of schmooze about some of these discussions.
Yashir Koach.
My
pleasure. We are going to email out to everybody just to remind you all that we are going to extend the class by 1 week after Shavuot. So everybody should keep that in mind, but we'll send a reminder out so you can mark it down in your calendars. I posted a couple links in the chat to some new classes. We have a three-part series starting tomorrow with Dr. Benny Gesundheit, as well as a one-off here tomorrow with Rabbi Mark Trencher. So please take a look at the website and keep yourselves up to date with everything we have going on. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. And thank you again, Rabbi Schwan.
I'll put in a plug to Dr. Benny Gesundheit's class. He's amazing.
Thank
we're
you.
We're very, very fortunate to have lots of amazing speakers here at Torah in Motion. So we're all very grateful and passionate. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Total pleasure.